A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
The high cost of living in Israel, one of the factors that's frequently blamed or the finger is pointed at is the import process, or that imports are controlled by a very small cluster of families. Basically a classic oligopoly model where those few importers might actually control large swathes of brands. I'd love to understand a little bit more about how the import process works. I'm going to give us a really practical and simple example to work with, just because we were talking about it lately. We were delving deep last week into the fascinating world of paint markers. Paint markers are these industrial grade markers that are used for widely in industrial applications. And a couple of brands that are very popular is Sakura from Japan and Edding from Germany. So I was talking to my good friend ChatGPT, asking, hey, I've gone through all these crappy markers that don't hold up outdoors. Can you recommend something that will just work? So I hear about this company called Edding, E-D-D-I-N-G. They're a German company, and they're like kind of the gold standard. These things are used, even certain solid markers are used in nuclear plants, no exaggeration, in the aerospace industry. And if you want something that is going to hold up to the weather, you buy Edding. So I searched for Edding and did an Israeli domain search. And then I begin seeing that these are kind of in specialty shops. Now, here's my question. This is a classic case of a small purchase that some local stationery stores aren't buying directly from Edding. Edding is selling, this is a typical model we see in Israel. Sometimes it's an exclusive distributor or an exclusive importer. And there's a curious feature of consumer warranties in Israel, where the warranty is offered through what's called the official importer, and that's considered like a good warranty status. So sometimes if you're looking at a more extensive purchase, let's say, I don't know, a $600 shekel consumer speaker, and you're going to find most things in Israel, the market is highly oligopolistic. If you're using a price comparison site, you often find very similar prices, but maybe for a tiny bit more, you'll be able to buy it from the exclusive importer. Now, my question is how this model actually works in terms of the business mechanics of it. If you are selling something, you might be selling these paint markers, and maybe the recommended retail price set by the German brand is $2. Do they typically have just unlimited, say in what they're going to sell at? Like they might say it's $6 is their price. And then, of course, there's the final price that is borne by consumers, because in this model, consumers don't typically buy from these wholesalers, although sometimes in Israel they do. And I presume that these intermediate layers don't have any control about the end price. To give a more maybe relatable example for people, there is IKEA in Israel, and you'll often be able to, the useful thing about IKEA is that because the product inventory is all these unique Swedish names, it's pretty straightforward to find how much does the, a certain item cost in IKEA in the US and IKEA in Ireland and IKEA in Israel. And you can often see that the Israeli price is 50% or sometimes even 100% more than the other IKEAs, even with accounting for currency exchange. So it seems like, I mean, on the one hand, I would say it seems like an attractive business proposition. If you take people like me who find these niches of products that they become passionate about and they like certain brands, I can see why it's a good business to form a relationship with a company and bring it in. But it's unfortunately taken on this connotation in Israel of this is where so much of the cost inflation actually traces back to. Does it have to be that way? Is there a ethical model to follow or a playbook? And really regarding the actual process for distributors, it's always interesting. I imagine there's a huge amount of competition for the big brands, let's say to become the Samsung distributor in Israel. If you take something at the far end, you know, let's take our Edding paint pens. If you find a great pen on a trip abroad in Italy and you say, wow, this is fantastic. People would love this in Israel. Sometimes you do see on the website these like become a distributor forms. What typically happens if you fill one of those out and you start the conversation with a foreign company? Israel is a small market, relatively speaking. It's got some political contours. How would that process typically pan out for somebody looking at becoming a distributor, importer for a business? Herman and Korn, over to you.
Daniel sent us this one, a practical question wrapped in a much bigger structural one. He's been hunting for Edding paint markers, the German industrial kind that'll actually survive outdoors, and what he found was the classic Israeli retail maze. A handful of specialty shops carry them, prices are all over the place, and if you want the version backed by the official importer warranty, there's a premium. His real question is, what's actually happening behind those price tags? How does the import and distribution model work in Israel? Why does it concentrate so heavily? And if someone wanted to become a niche distributor themselves, what would that process even look like?
The paint marker example is perfect because it's small enough to see the mechanics clearly. A $3 pen from Germany versus a $6 pen in a Tel Aviv specialty shop. The gap isn't shipping, it's layers.
The Israeli economic speciality.
Let's start with the actual architecture because once you see it, you can't unsee it. In most developed economies, when a foreign brand wants to sell products, they have options. They can open a subsidiary. They can work with multiple distributors. They can sell direct to retailers or direct to consumers. In Israel, the system has evolved differently. There's a legal mechanism called parallel import that technically allows anyone to bring in genuine products from abroad without the manufacturer's permission. But here's the twist. The official importer designation carries a warranty obligation under Israeli consumer protection law that parallel importers don't have to honor in the same way.
The warranty becomes a moat.
The official importer is required by law to provide service, repairs, and replacements. A parallel importer can technically offer their own warranty, but consumers know the official one is backed by regulation. So that official importer badge on the box isn't just marketing. It's a regulatory advantage that lets them charge more.
In the paint marker case, the warranty question is almost absurd. It's a $3 pen. Nobody's filing a warranty claim on a paint marker. But the structure scales up. For a 600 shekel speaker, suddenly that official warranty matters a lot.
And this is where the oligopoly concern becomes real. The official importer for a given brand often controls not just the warranty channel, but the relationship with major retail chains. If you're a big Israeli retailer like Shufersal or a major electronics chain, you want supply certainty, you want return policies, you want marketing support. The official importer provides all of that. The parallel importer might have a container of product that arrived last week at a slightly lower cost, but they can't guarantee they'll have stock next month.
The retailer defaults to the official channel, and the official channel knows it.
There's a 2023 Bank of Israel report that found import concentration is one of the top three drivers of Israel's cost of living premium relative to OECD averages. They specifically identified that in food and consumer goods, a small number of importers controlled the vast majority of market share for foreign products.
How small a number are we talking?
In food, something like five families or groups control an estimated 60 to 70% of the import market. The Diplomat Group, Nitto, Willy Food, Shestowitz, and a few others. In consumer electronics, it's similarly concentrated. Banda Magnetic, for example, is the official distributor for Samsung and several other major electronics brands. If you want to sell Samsung products in Israel through official channels, you're dealing with one company.
One company for a market of 9 million people. That's the definition of a bottleneck.
The bottleneck has history. For decades, Israel was a small, somewhat isolated economy with currency controls and protectionist policies. Building an import business required navigating Hebrew language bureaucracy, customs regulations, kosher certification for food products, and a whole set of standards that were often unique to Israel. The families that invested in that infrastructure decades ago built moats that are genuinely hard to cross.
The paint marker is downstream of five decades of trade policy.
It really is. So let's walk through the specific mechanics Daniel asked about. Suppose Edding, the German marker company, sets a recommended retail price of $2 per marker. That's what they suggest. But Edding sells to their distributor at a wholesale price, maybe 80 cents or a dollar. The distributor then sells to retailers. And here's the key. Edding's recommended retail price has no legal force. It's a suggestion. The distributor and the retailer set the actual shelf price.
In a market with multiple competing distributors, competition would push that shelf price towards something resembling the recommended price. In a market with one distributor, the math changes.
The official importer can essentially set whatever price the market will bear. If they know that parallel import is limited, whether by warranty concerns, by retailer relationships, or by the sheer hassle of bringing in small quantities, they have pricing power. They might set their wholesale price so that the retail price lands at $4 instead of $2, maybe $6 if the product has a niche following and consumers don't have easy alternatives.
Which is exactly what Daniel found. Specialty shop prices for Edding markers that were noticeably higher than what you'd expect from the European retail price.
Here's where it gets even more interesting. The official importer doesn't necessarily want to maximize price on every single unit. They want to maximize total profit across the market. For a niche product like industrial paint markers, the market might be relatively price insensitive up to a point. The people who need these markers, artists, industrial users, people doing outdoor signage, they need them specifically. They'll pay a premium, so the importer can set prices quite high without losing many sales.
The IKEA comparison is instructive here because IKEA doesn't use the official importer model. IKEA Israel is a franchise operation, but it's owned and run by IKEA through a complex corporate structure. They control their own supply chain. And yet, as Daniel noted, Israeli IKEA prices are frequently 50 to 100% higher than the same product in the United States or Ireland, even after accounting for exchange rates.
That tells you it's not just the import oligopoly. There are multiple forces at work. Part of it is that Israel requires products to meet specific standards. Electrical goods need Israeli standard plugs and certification. Furniture needs to meet certain fire safety standards. Food needs kosher certification. All of that adds cost.
50 to 100% more? That's not certification. That's what the market will bear.
And IKEA Israel knows that the alternative for Israeli consumers isn't driving to IKEA in Cyprus. The alternative is paying Israeli prices for Israeli furniture, which are also high. The entire price floor in Israel is elevated. So even a company that's not part of the traditional import oligopoly, IKEA controls its own supply chain, still prices to the local market rather than to some global benchmark.
The paint marker sits at the intersection of both forces. You've got a niche product where the official importer has pricing power, and you've got a broader market where consumers are accustomed to paying more. Nobody's shocked that a German industrial marker costs $6. They might be annoyed, but they're not shocked.
Let's talk about the become a distributor forms Daniel mentioned. This is the practical question at the heart of the prompt. Suppose you're in Italy, you find a fantastic pen, and the company's website has a form that says become a distributor. You fill it out. What happens next?
First, the company checks whether they already have distribution in Israel. If they do, and it's an exclusive arrangement, the conversation probably ends there. Exclusivity is the default in these agreements, especially for smaller brands entering foreign markets. The brand doesn't want to manage relationships with multiple importers in a small country.
The exclusivity is often territorial. Israel and sometimes the Palestinian Authority territories as a bundled region. The brand wants one partner who handles everything: customs clearance, Hebrew labeling, regulatory compliance, marketing, retailer relationships, warranty service. For a small or mid-sized foreign company, managing all of that directly for a market of 9 million people simply isn't worth the overhead. They want one reliable partner.
The barrier to entry isn't just the existing importer relationships. It's that the entire model is built around exclusive territorial partnerships. If you want to bring in a brand that already has an official importer, you're either buying out that importer's agreement, expensive, or you're trying to convince the brand to break exclusivity, which they're unlikely to do for a small market.
Unless the existing importer is underperforming. That's the one crack in the door. If the official importer isn't marketing the product well, isn't getting it into enough retail channels, isn't hitting sales targets, the brand might be open to a change. But even then, the existing importer often has a contract with years left on it, and breaking it means legal costs and relationship damage.
What about a brand that doesn't yet have any Israeli distribution? Daniel's hypothetical Italian pen company that's never sold a single unit in Israel.
That's where it gets interesting and more accessible. For a brand with no existing Israeli presence, the process is open. You reach out, you demonstrate that you understand the Israeli market, you show you can handle the logistics, and you negotiate terms. Typically, the foreign company will want to see a business plan, some evidence of financial stability, and a clear go-to-market strategy. They'll want minimum order quantities. You might need to commit to buying, say, $10,000 of product up front. They'll want to know which retail channels you can access.
This is where being a small, scrappy operator can actually work. For a niche product like specialty markers, the big import families probably aren't interested. The total market might be a few $100,000 a year. That's not worth their time. But for an individual entrepreneur who is passionate about the product, it could be a viable small business.
The import oligopoly is concentrated at the top. The big consumer brands, the major electronics, the food conglomerates. But in niche categories, there's actually a long tail of small importers and distributors. Specialty coffee roasters, craft beer importers, boutique stationery suppliers. The challenge isn't that the oligopoly blocks every possible product. It's that the oligopoly controls the products most people buy most often.
The paint marker entrepreneur has a path. It's narrow, it requires capital and persistence, but it exists. The Samsung distributor aspirant has no path. That territory was locked down decades ago.
Locked down with contracts that are extremely hard to dislodge. I want to talk about a specific case that illustrates how entrenched this gets. The Diplomat Group, which I mentioned earlier, distributes everything from Procter & Gamble products to Mondelez snacks to Energizer batteries. They built a distribution infrastructure that reaches every supermarket, every convenience store, every kiosk in the country. If you're a foreign consumer goods company and you want your product on shelves in Israel, Diplomat can do that for you in a matter of weeks. A new entrant would need years to build equivalent relationships.
The infrastructure itself is the moat. It's not just the contract, it's the trucks, the warehouses, the relationships with retail buyers, the integration with retail ordering systems.
The regulatory knowledge. Israeli labeling requirements are specific. Kosher certification for food products is a whole separate process. Electrical standards are different from both European and American standards. A new importer has to learn all of this, make mistakes, absorb the costs of rejected shipments and regulatory delays. The existing players have amortized that learning over decades.
We've got a system where the official importer designation creates a warranty advantage, exclusive territorial contracts, lock-in relationships, distribution infrastructure, creates high barriers to entry, and the broader Israeli price environment means consumers are somewhat inured to paying more. What's the ethical playbook here? Daniel asked whether it has to be this way.
There are a few models that work differently. One is the parallel import reform that's been discussed in the Knesset for years. The idea is to make it easier for parallel importers to compete by requiring manufacturers to honor warranties regardless of import channel. The European Union has something like this. If you buy a Samsung product from an authorized dealer anywhere in the EU, the warranty is valid across the entire bloc. Israel could adopt similar rules, but the political resistance from the existing importers is substantial.
The importers argue they've invested in service centers and warranty infrastructure, and parallel importers would free ride on that investment.
Which is a legitimate argument up to a point. But the counter-argument is that the current system essentially grants legal monopolies on warranty service, and consumers pay the monopoly premium.
Another model is what some niche importers do, the transparent model. They say, look, we're bringing in this product, here's what we paid, here's our markup, here's the shelf price. The value we add is curation, quality assurance, and actual warranty support. We're not hiding behind an official badge. We're earning the premium through service.
That can work for enthusiast markets. The craft beer importer who visits Belgian breweries, selects specific batches, handles cold chain logistics, and educates retailers and consumers about the product. That's genuine value creation, not rent seeking. The problem is that this model doesn't scale to mass market products. Nobody needs curation for Energizer batteries.
The ethical question is really about market power. If you're the sole importer of a niche product, and you're charging a reasonable markup that reflects your actual costs, plus a fair profit, nobody's going to write angry articles about you. If you're the sole importer of a household staple, and you're charging double what it costs in Europe because consumers have no alternative, that's where the oligopoly critique lands.
The critique is that in Israel, too many product categories fall into that second bucket. There was a 2024 OECD report that found Israeli consumers pay on average 20 to 30% more for comparable consumer goods than the OECD average, and import concentration was cited as a significant contributing factor.
20 to 30% is the average, which means some categories are much worse.
Food products, cosmetics, and consumer electronics tend to be the worst offenders. Products where brand loyalty is high and substitution is difficult.
Which brings us back to adding paint markers. High brand loyalty, difficult substitution for specific industrial applications, niche enough that the big importers might not bother, but specialized enough that whoever does import them has pricing power.
Daniel's experience, finding them in specialty shops at elevated prices, with the official importer version commanding a premium, is the system working exactly as designed. The official importer invested in the relationship with Edding handles the logistics, provides the warranty, and prices accordingly. The parallel importers bring in smaller quantities, maybe from European wholesalers, and price slightly lower but without the warranty badge. Consumers choose which bundle they prefer.
The question of whether this is ethical depends on the markup. A 50% premium over European retail might reflect genuine costs and a reasonable profit. A 300% premium starts looking like rent extraction.
The transparency problem is that consumers usually can't tell which situation they're in. They don't know the wholesale price, the shipping costs, the regulatory compliance costs, or the importer's margin. They just see the shelf price and compare it to what they vaguely remember paying abroad, or what they can find on a foreign website.
There's a specific dynamic Daniel touched on that's worth unpacking. He mentioned that on Israeli price comparison sites, you often see very similar prices across retailers for the same product, and the official importer version is only slightly more expensive. That similarity isn't competition, it's the opposite. It's a sign that the wholesale price is effectively fixed, and retailers are all working off the same cost basis.
In a competitive market, you'd expect to see price dispersion. Different retailers would have different cost structures, different inventory positions, different promotional strategies. When every retailer is priced within a few shekels of each other, it suggests they're all buying from the same source at essentially the same price.
The parallel import option is supposed to break that uniformity. In theory, a parallel importer finds a cheaper source, brings in a container, and undercuts the official channel. In practice, as we've discussed, the warranty issue, the retailer relationships, and the supply consistency problem limit, how much parallel import actually happens.
There's another factor that doesn't get discussed enough. Israel's ports are a bottleneck. Customs clearance can be slow and unpredictable. The cost of storing containers while waiting for clearance adds up. For a small parallel importer, a few weeks of port delays can wipe out the margin advantage they had over the official importer, who has dedicated logistics staff and long-standing relationships with customs brokers.
The system has multiple self-reinforcing mechanisms. The warranty moat, the retail relationship moat, the logistics moat, the regulatory knowledge moat. Each one individually might be surmountable. Together, they create a structure that's extremely resistant to new entry.
Let's get practical for someone thinking about becoming a niche distributor. Suppose you found that Italian Pin, the company, has no Israeli presence, and you filled out the form. The conversation will likely cover several specific points. First, exclusivity. You'll want it, though want to grant it only with performance conditions. Second, territory. Israel proper, or Israel plus the Palestinian territories, which is a common bundling. Third, minimum order quantities and payment terms. Fourth, marketing commitments. Will you translate their website into Hebrew, run social media, attend trade shows? Fifth, regulatory compliance. Who handles Hebrew labeling? Who handles any required testing or certification?
Sixth, the warranty question. If you're the official importer, Israeli law requires you to provide warranty service. For a $3 pen, that might mean you just replace defective units. For a $600 speaker, you need actual repair capability or a relationship with a service center.
The warranty obligation is costly, It's not just a legal formality. You need to stock spare parts, train staff, handle customer complaints, process returns. For a small importer, this can be the single largest operational challenge.
Which is why some small importers essentially self-insure. They price in a certain percentage of returns and replacements, and they just ship a new unit to any customer who has a problem. For low-cost items, that's often cheaper than maintaining a formal service infrastructure.
It can actually create a better customer experience than the official channel. If the official importer makes you fill out forms and wait 2 weeks for a repair, and the small importer just sends you a replacement overnight, the small importer wins on service even without the official badge.
That's the kind of competitive advantage that can work in niche markets. You can't do it with refrigerators, but you can do it with paint markers and specialty pens and craft supplies.
Let's talk about the political dimension, because Daniel mentioned Israel's political contours affecting the import landscape. There are a few specific ways this matters. First, the Arab League boycott, though largely dormant, created a historical pattern where some global brands avoided Israel or used third country intermediaries. That legacy of indirect distribution added layers and costs that persist in some categories.
Second, the regulatory alignment question. Israel often adopts European standards with modifications, which means products designed for the EU market may still need adjustments. The cost of those adjustments gets amortized over a small market of 9 million rather than a market of 450 million.
Third, the security situation creates supply chain contingencies that importers have to price in. If you're bringing in containers through Ashdod or Haifa, you need backup plans for periods of disruption. The official importers maintain larger buffer stocks than they would in a more predictable environment, and that inventory cost gets passed through to consumers.
None of these are excuses for a 300% markup, but they are genuine cost factors that often get overlooked in the "it's all oligopoly greed" narrative.
The truth is, it's both. There are real structural costs that make importing to Israel more expensive than importing to, say, the Netherlands. And there is genuine market power being exercised by concentrated importers who face limited competition. Separating those two effects is difficult, which is part of why the policy debate is so messy.
The IKEA comparison helps isolate the market power effect. IKEA controls its own supply chain, so the traditional import oligopoly doesn't apply. They have the skill to handle regulatory compliance efficiently. And yet Israeli prices are dramatically higher than elsewhere. That gap is mostly what the market will bear.
Which suggests that even if you reformed the import oligopoly, you'd still have elevated prices in many categories because the broader Israeli market structure, retail concentration, regulatory costs, consumer expectations, supports higher price levels.
What would actually move the needle? If someone in the Knesset was serious about bringing down consumer prices, what would they do?
The most effective lever is probably warranty reform. If you require manufacturers to honor warranties regardless of import channel, meaning the warranty attaches to the product, not to the specific importer, you eliminate the biggest competitive advantage of the official importers. Parallel import becomes viable, and official importers have to compete on price and service rather than on a regulatory monopoly.
The European model.
The EU's rules on warranty and parallel trade are far more consumer-friendly. If you buy a genuine Samsung product from an authorized dealer in any EU country, Samsung Europe is obligated to honor the warranty. Israel could adopt something similar, but it would require cooperation from the global manufacturers, who might resist because the current system gives their official distributors protected markets.
The official distributors in Israel are politically connected. This isn't a technical policy question, it's a political economy question. The families and companies that benefit from the current system have influence.
Always the story. The second lever is reducing non-tariff barriers, simplifying the standards alignment process, reducing the unique Israeli requirements that don't serve genuine safety or consumer protection purposes, speeding up port clearance. Each of these individually is small, but together they add significant friction that advantages incumbents.
The third lever, which is harder, is retail competition. Even if you fix the import side, if the retail sector is also concentrated, consumers still face high prices. But that's a whole separate episode.
It really is. Let me circle back to Daniel's specific situation with the paint markers, because there's a useful framework here for anyone navigating the Israeli import market as a consumer or as a potential entrepreneur. For consumers, the question is whether the official importer premium is worth paying. For a $3 pen, probably not. The cost of failure is low, and the parallel import version is functionally identical. For a $600 speaker, the warranty math changes. You're paying maybe 10 or 15% more for the official version, and you're buying peace of mind on a significant purchase.
For the aspiring importer, the question is whether the category is large enough to support a business, but small enough that the existing oligopoly doesn't care. The sweet spot is products where you can add genuine value through curation and service, where the official importer either doesn't exist or is underperforming, and where you can build direct relationships with retailers who are underserved by the current distribution system.
The paint marker category might actually be in that sweet spot. It's too small for the big import families to care deeply about. It's a product where enthusiasts care about quality and are willing to pay for it. And if you can build a reputation as the person who brings in the best industrial markers from Japan and Germany with reliable stock and fast shipping, you might build a nice little business.
The unsexy truth of niche importing is that it's a logistics business with a passion overlay. Most of the work is customs forms, warehouse management, retailer invoicing, and customer service. The fun part, discovering great products abroad, is maybe 10% of the job.
The other 90% is exactly the infrastructure that the big import families spent decades building. That's why they have the moat. It's not glamorous, but it's hard to replicate.
There's a broader point here about the Israeli economy that I think gets lost in the oligopoly critique. The system evolved the way it did for reasons. Israel was a small, relatively poor country, with a siege economy mentality for its first few decades. Building domestic industrial capacity and controlling imports were seen as national security imperatives, not just economic policies. The import families emerged in that context, and they built real infrastructure that served real needs.
The critique isn't that they exist. It's that the protections they were granted in a different era haven't been unwound, as Israel has become a wealthy, globally integrated economy. The import concentration that made sense in 1970 doesn't make the same sense in 2026, but the incumbents have had 50 years to entrench.
The entrenchment isn't just economic, it's cultural. Israelis have internalized the idea that the official importer is the safe choice, that paying more for the authorized version is prudent, that the parallel import market is sketchy, that consumer mindset is itself a barrier to competition.
Consumer education is part of the solution, but it's a slow part. Changing the legal framework around warranties would be faster, but it requires political will that hasn't materialized. The last serious attempt at parallel import reform in the Knesset was watered down after intense lobbying.
For now, the paint marker buyer in Tel Aviv pays $6 for a pen that costs $2 in Berlin, and the system shrugs.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the ancient Basque language, the ergative case marker K attaches to the subject of a transitive verb, meaning the woman sees the mountain, is structured chemically like the woman K sees the mountain. A grammatical alignment so rare that only a handful of languages worldwide use it, and Basque has done so continuously since before the Romans reached Iberia.
Right. The takeaway from all of this, I think, is that the import system in Israel isn't a simple story of greedy middlemen, but it's also not a story of innocent market forces. It's a historically evolved structure that now serves incumbents very well and consumers poorly. The paint marker is a tiny example of a dynamic that plays out across thousands of products, and the cumulative effect is that Israeli households pay a significant premium for the simple act of buying things.
For anyone looking at that become a distributor form, the answer is, it's possible. People do it. The niche import business exists, and some operators thrive in it, but go in with clear eyes about what the job actually is. It's logistics, regulation, relationship management, and patience. The passion for the product is what gets you started, but it won't carry you through the customs delays.
The question that sits with me is whether the current pressure on cost of living in Israel, which has become one of the dominant political issues, will finally produce reform that previous decades couldn't. The OECD keeps flagging import concentration. The Bank of Israel keeps flagging it. Consumers feel it every time they open their wallets. At some point, the political calculus shifts.
Or doesn't. The incumbents have survived reform attempts before, but the pressure is higher now than it's been in a long time.
This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want to dig deeper into the economics behind your grocery bill, we've put some resources at my weird prompts.
Until next time.
We're done here.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.